Henry Kissinger is dead at 100 years of age. I wasn't planning to do a podcast this week, but his death has prompted me to jump on and offer some thoughts on Henry Kissinger, his life, his role in world history. Did he define the world order we live in? Did he envision the world order of the future? Or was he just a war criminal? Has the greatest generation of American diplomacy died? But first, let's listen to this fragment of the Burning Archive from the early 1980s. A prophecy, perhaps a little bit early, but ultimately correct. So welcome everyone, I am Jeff Rich. This is the Burning Archive podcast where I talk about history, culture and how our world is changing today. And Henry Kissinger's death is as good a prompt to discuss those issues as any. If you haven't listened to the podcast before, I hope you enjoy this one. I'm going to explore Henry Kissinger's life legacy, his ideas about world order, his perhaps most famous achievement, but was it really his achievement? The pivot to China in the early 1970s. And then finally, ask whether Kissinger is perhaps the last of the deaths of the grandees of US diplomacy in the Cold War era, and perhaps the death of US diplomacy or the diplomacy of the American Empire overall. So Henry Kissinger is dead at 100 years of age. There were a whole series of articles a few months ago that commented on the centenary of his birth, and a number of those have been reflected upon after his death. This is a significant event. He has his finger in a lot of pies of the 20th century, Henry Kissinger. And it's right that people reflect on his character and his achievements and what it tells us about where the world is going today. Kissinger won the Nobel Prize together with his Vietnamese colleague in 1974 for the negotiation of the Paris Peace Accords that brought an end to the Vietnam War. And it was the war in Indochina that, in a way, has dominated the doubts about Henry Kissinger's moral culpability ever since, and also perhaps was the real reason, the overextension of the US in China and its concerns about achieving some sort of detente with the Soviet Union, that also led to his great achievement of moving the US to establish relationships with the People's Republic of China in 1972. He's widely regarded by many as a war criminal, particularly for his role in, well, quite a few things, really. There's the bombings in Cambodia and Laos and Vietnam, in which millions died, and which people still suffer from today. There was his involvement in the great American tradition of extralegal killings in South America. There was his complicity with deaths of millions of people in Bangladesh, and his generally fairly, you could say Europhile, you could say neo-colonial attitude towards the rest of the world. But nonetheless, he was the leader of foreign policy in the United States under Richard Nixon, and then Gerald Ford, but from the 1980s, his role was as like a grandee and consultant, advising many of the world's largest corporations on their own international relations, making himself rich, but still articulating, I guess, a vision of American grand strategy that over time grew increasingly at odds with the approach of American foreign policy from the early 1990s. He remained a realist, if that's an appropriate term, and even towards the end of his life, he was cautioning America against its confrontational approach with both Russia and China, and urging America to live in the world with other great states, accepting that it is not the king of the mountain. Even this year, Henry Kissinger visited Beijing and met with Xi Jinping, so his status, his influence remained until his 100th year, and the debates on his legacy and his role have been occurring, well, really since the early 1970s all the way till today. The Toxic Nixons, the punk band I played briefly at the start of the show, urged Kissinger's death in the early 1980s. They had to wait another 40 years to see their wish realized. But on the other hand, there are others like Neil Ferguson, the British American historian who wrote a obituary for Henry Kissinger in the Wall Street Journal entitled Henry Kissinger's Century, who celebrates Kissinger and sees him as the great champion of realistically imperial foreign policy for the United States. In some ways, the debate about Kissinger involves the same sort of issues in the debate about Napoleon that has been provoked by Ridley Scott's film. The good things that Napoleon did outweighed by all the people who died in the battles that he conducted. Is Napoleon flotsam and jetsam on the deeper forces of history, or is Napoleon, and similarly Henry Kissinger, a great figure who shapes the events of the century? Curiously, also, it's important to remember Kissinger was not alone. It might be Henry Kissinger's century in Neil Ferguson's view, but arguably Richard Nixon had a much greater role in the central events of Kissinger's real diplomacy. Indeed, Mao Zedong, who, after all, did meet with Henry Kissinger as America tried to pivot towards China in 1972. Mao Zedong described Henry Kissinger as, and I quote here from Odd Arne Westad's excellent book, The Cold War, A World History. Kissinger, Mao told the Vietnamese in 1970s, quote, is a stinking scholar, a university professor who does not know anything about diplomacy. And indeed, even his boss, the main president Kissinger really served, Richard Nixon, had some pretty profound doubts about Kissinger's character, as was caught on tape in the White House, because Richard Nixon recorded those conversations.
Hi, anything else?
At my talk with Haig.
And what did he say?
Well, he said he understands it completely, the problem. And he said, in fact, he understands it. He says, in some ways, it's worse than you think it is. And he understands it better than I realize he does. And he said, the thing you just got to face, and it's a very real and, in his view, very serious problem, is that Henry is paranoid. And that it's to the point where the guy, he said that interview with that Italian woman was a psychological...
He came in and told me about today that he did not told her that. He told her things that were positive, and she turned them to negatives and so forth. And he may be right.
Well,
she may be on the left winger that turned it all around.
Haig doesn't believe that.
He doesn't tell?
Haig believes that Henry was under pressure at the time. He knows he was. He did it just before he was leaving.
Yeah.
He did it in the morning. And that he pulled this stuff. He said he's done it over there. Haig is concerned enough about him that he's called that doctor. You know, Dr. Weber or whatever his name is.
Yeah.
He says, you've got to ride through the negotiation cycle. And he says he's convinced that's going to work out. But he said, as soon as that's done, Henry has got to, at the very least, he has got to be gotten away for a, you know, good 2-week vacation or something in Acapulco or,
yeah,
or Puerto Rico or something, you know. He says Henry goes through cycles. Haig has always had this theory, as you know.
Yeah.
Of ups and downs, and he's in a down cycle. He thinks he's on his way back up now. He says he's not as worried now as he was 2 weeks ago.
Right. Okay. Well, that's good. Anything else?
No.
Kissinger may well have been paranoid. He may well have been mad, but we will leave the character analysis for another day. I guess his intellectual reputation to some degree is very much around his writings on world order. He wrote a book called World Order, and that book in itself was a kind of distillation of his initial work as a scholar of a history of diplomacy, who studied particularly closely the balance of power politics in Europe after the Congress of Vienna, since we're talking about Napoleon in 1814, and in the Westphalian system since the mid 17th century. It is a very European, view of world order that Nixon develops, and he sort of transplants the idea of balancing powers to the United States' unique, privileged, and temporary role after World War II of having an economic strategic dominance of much of the world. In this context, world domination was not an unrealistic objective. It seemed to be more an established fact, and Kissinger practiced a kind of realistic balancing power to do so. But it's questionable whether he really had such deep insights into the nature of global historical change that was going on, or rather whether he did not just tend to interpret world events against the mental model he developed in the 50s and the 60s based on his study of events in Europe after the 30 Years' War and the Congress of Vienna. He was certainly an erudite scholar and a snappy intellectual, but whether he really had deep, profound insights to the changing world today is a different question. There's an excellent post on Twitter X by Nina Byzantina, shout out to Nina if you're listening, that comments that Kissinger is a Europhile and his role models are very much Metternich and Bismarck from the 19th century. Nina Byzantina writes, comparing them to the modern last men type of politicians, it's easy to see why Kissinger admired this world rather than others. And arguably, Kissinger found in Nixon a figure not unlike Metternich and Bismarck. But his analysis, Nina Byzantina notes, very much relies on old tropes about nomadic hordes, in quotation marks, And if you haven't listened to my interview with Marie Favreau about what the Golden Horde and the Mongol Empire was really like, this is another reminder of the importance of actually really understanding this old trope of the nomadic horde. But anyhow, returning to Nina Byzantina, he relies on many of the old tropes about nomadic hordes and the hard school of the steppe informing Russian foreign policy. And even into his later years, he would often comment about the risk of, you know, the Russian Empire reverting to its primitive racial type and wanting to, you know, expand the empire and conquer the more civilized parts of the world. So he very much saw himself in the tradition of Metternich and of Bismarck as a great diplomat, or Talleyrand even, the great diplomat Talleyrand, who's featured in the film Napoleon, as the great realistic diplomat, in a way a conservative diplomat who seeks a realistic balancing of power around the world and pursues reason of state even if it compromises other moral principles. How much this grand strategy was a after the fact rationalization of many pragmatic, more partial decisions about political compromises and temporary crises and all the rest is a matter for debate, as we will see in the section where I talk about China and the opening of the US to China in 1972. But I think in many ways this idea that Kissinger was had a great vision of the world is a little bit of successful marketing by Kissinger, not really justified by the quality of history, of global history, the quality of thinking about international relations that Kissinger deployed. In the end, Kissinger was perhaps that curious feature of the modern age, an astonishingly successful ex-academic, ex-government consultant who traded on a reputation out of a relatively brief career in government and a long out-of-date academic career in history to become one of the great men of international diplomacy. What about the great achievement of Kissinger's life, the opening of the United States to China in 1972? This story is often rerun these days as a masterstroke of grand strategy of America, of dividing the two communist states against each other and turning China towards the United States. It's just a pity that China didn't play the game fairly after that. But in reality, the picture was quite different, and it was not really Henry Kissinger's grand vision alone that led to this. And the story of this important moment when Nixon went to China, and before him when Kissinger went to China, is told in Odd Arne Westad's book, The Cold War, A World History. There's a chapter there, Nixon in Beijing, and it brilliantly sets out the real constraints and considerations that are often forgotten now in terms of Kissinger's opening towards China. First of all, in a way, the key concern of the United States at that point was détente with the Soviet Union. It was not an aggressive split off of China so much as a way to help induce the Soviet Union to stronger negotiations with the United States around détente, from a position where, America felt under threat. It was only in 1971 that Richard Nixon had taken America off the gold standard in order to keep its empire, I guess, at lower cost to itself. It was bogged down in Indochina. It was being defeated in Indochina. And there was a strong sense, including from China, including from Mao Zedong, that it was the Soviet Union, not the United States, that was the rising superpower. It was the Soviet Union that appeared to have the military strength. So the negotiations around the opening to China were very much around that broader picture of world balancing of power. And it was also something that was, as much as anything, designed, conceived, executed by Richard Nixon as much as Henry Kissinger. In fact, old Arne Westad says that Henry Kissinger had doubts about his national security advisor's negotiating skills, yet he still sent Kissinger to Beijing as his advance man. And it was then, in July 1971, that Kissinger covertly flew under the cover of a trip to Pakistan, which had been widely publicised, to have his first meeting with the Chinese government, which at this point the United States had still refused to recognise and was still militarising its floating aircraft carrier of Taiwan. Kissinger flew to Beijing, where he was welcomed by the Chinese Premier Zhou Enlai. Old Arne Westad continues with the comment that, awestruck at being the first American leader to visit communist China, Kissinger began reading from a prepared text. Zhao cut him short. China, he said, was hoping for coexistence, equality, and friendship. But for that to happen, the United States must recognize the PRC as the sole legitimate government of China and not make any exceptions. Just as we recognize the United States as the sole legitimate government without considering Hawaii, the last state, which parenthetically I add was only became a state in 1959, 13 years prior to this meeting. Just as we recognize the United States as the sole legitimate government without considering Hawaii, the last state, an exception to your sovereignty, or still less Long Island, a closer parallel perhaps to Taiwan off the coast of New York. In other words, the US relationship with Taiwan had to go. Yet, for all his genius about world order, for all his desire to establish better relationships between China and America, Henry Kissinger was utterly, utterly failed over the next 50 years to persuade the American elite to accept the realities of the People's Republic of China. And we still have this confrontational issue between China and the United States over Taiwan. So the third little set of reflections, I guess, on Henry Kissinger relate to Kissinger not as a unique individual, a unique expression of American diplomacy, a uniquely great statesman and diplomat, a person who defined the 20th century, Henry Kissinger's century, so much as one of a set of grand old men of American diplomacy who have died in recent years, and who had a profound influence over American diplomacy, not always beneficial influence over American diplomacy. George Shultz, Zbigniew Brzezinski come to mind in particular. But there were a range of others. George Kennan, Chaz Freeman is one of the sort of junior or very, very minor government officials who supported Henry Kissinger in his diplomacy with China, and he is still alive and he despairs at the quality of American diplomacy. But in a way, I think after Henry Kissinger left office in the mid to late 1970s and went into consulting and impressions management instead, Zbigniew Brzezinski, the Polish-American ideologue, really, of foreign policy, the author of The Grand Chessboard, with its dreams of American dominance of Eurasia. Zbigniew Brzezinski increasingly came to dominate, I guess, the intellectual horizons of American foreign policy more than Henry Kissinger. And I don't think really in a good way. It's perhaps fitting that it was towards the end of his life that Henry Kissinger kind of went against the consensus and said, well, gee, maybe the United States should actually negotiate with Russia over Ukraine and recognize some of the legitimate concerns there. He was howled down by all the supporters of Zbigniew Brzezinski, who long had the project to weaken the Soviet Union and then Russia through Ukraine, amongst other places. But this, there is this sense that a generation of perhaps more realistic and perhaps more capable American diplomats has passed away. In their place, there is less capable, more ideological, and more dangerous diplomatic cultures, diplomatic institutions, diplomatic leaders in the United States. It's a culture, a set of culture, institutions, and leaders that perhaps leads Joe Biden to call Xi Jinping a dictator a few hours after meeting with him on matters of shared interest. Indeed, Chaz Freeman, the very, very minor government official who travelled with Henry Kissinger to China, has recently said that in retrospect, he thinks that over the last 30 years, America stopped practicing diplomacy and started merely practicing imperial administration. It's an interesting thought, and it will be interesting to see how the American diplomatic and international relations community responds to one of these, to the passing of Henry Kissinger as a important, iconic figure of a time when American diplomacy did seem to command the world. It no longer does. So let me wrap up. It's odd, I think, coincidental that in the same week that I watched the film Napoleon, and I also did a video review of the film on my YouTube channel, which you can check out at the Burning Archive YouTube channel. It's done very well, I gotta say, so do check it out. That Henry Kissinger's died, because they both present this question, you know, how do you assess a person who exerts great power, but in so doing must do the bad, at times even evil, things that great states demand, perhaps, of leaders? How do you assess the role of a great person versus all the others around them, all the institutions and all the cultures and the deep underlying forces of culture and structure in history? They seem to be the questions that in part pivot on Henry Kissinger, but I think also there is a particular question with Henry Kissinger that so much of his diplomacy did involve committing horrible, horrible crimes, the bombing of Indochina and all the rest of it. But as I think Thomas Fazzi says in a terrific, terrific article that was published a few months back on the occasion of Henry Kissinger's 100th birthday, the fact is Kissinger was not alone. He writes, was Kissinger an arch-imperialist or an arch-peacemaker? In a sense, he was neither. Both sides of the Kissinger Wars tend to overemphasize his influence on US foreign policy during the 70s, ignoring the deeper systemic trends at play. Insofar as Kissinger's aggressive interventionism is concerned, this should be situated within the grander picture of the structural violence that has characterized the American empire, both before and after he was in office. In many ways, I think it's ironic that Henry Kissinger, who was a product of, who was a student rather, of a scholar of the politics of the Congress of Vienna, the politics of the Concert of Europe in the 19th century, which was very much a kind of a conservative reaction to Napoleon's expansionist ideological empire in the early 19th century. It's ironic that he perhaps sought to implement a less ideologically confrontational foreign policy in America, but after his departure from office, a progressive, more universalistic ideological expansion of the American empire, the belief in American exceptionalism, really took hold and drove America to the disastrous dream of its unipolar world. And if there is a significant achievement to praise Henry Kissinger for, together I would say with Richard Nixon, I think it is summarized well by Odd Arne Westad in his book The Cold War. He notes how in the mid-70s people wanted détente. They wanted, and indeed perhaps the most significant outcome of Kissinger's visit to Beijing was in fact the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty, the beginning really of nuclear disarmament that it provoked. It hurried along the Soviet Union and the United States coming to an agreement to reduce nuclear arms a few months after that meeting. Arne Westad notes it's that broader sense in which Nixon and Kissinger attempted to, if you like, bring an early end to the Cold War in the early 1970s. That is perhaps his lasting achievement and his most enduring failure, because it all fell apart after that, not least because of the influences of people like Zbigniew Brzezinski. Westad says, even though the détente process was haphazard and on some critical issues contradictory, it had taken real courage to bring it to where it was by 1975. The aging Brezhnev had made it into his life's work and believed it would preserve peace, even as he and his colleagues in Marxist terms began suspecting that global capitalism had entered a structural crisis that advantaged the Soviet Union in international affairs. The Chinese leaders also deserve some approbation for breaking with the past, even though they wanted to use the security they had gained for further nefarious purposes at home. It was, however, Richard Nixon who had made it all possible. Because he fundamentally distrusted his own people, Nixon had forced US foreign policy onto a track where for the first time during the Cold War, it dealt with others on the assumption that US global hegemony would not last forever. And perhaps the lasting, the most bitter condemnation of Henry Kissinger is from the early 1980s, he really indulged and propped up the belief in American exceptionalism and betrayed the work of both his own work, that of his fellow diplomats, and that of Richard Nixon, that perhaps might have led the United States to live with more equanimity with the other powers of the world. Many, many podcasts, no doubt, will be out there reflecting on Henry Kissinger. I hope you've enjoyed my reflections. I hope they're maybe a bit different to some others. If you want to read more of what I have to say about things in world history, geopolitics, culture, then the simplest and best thing you can do is to subscribe to my newsletter at jeffrich.substack.com. You can do it for free, or you can also make a contribution to my writing if you wish. I'd also say look out if you can for any podcasts or chats on the radio from Neil Ferguson, not necessarily a person I would agree with on many issues, but he is the biographer of Henry Kissinger. So his reflections on Kissinger will be of interest, even if they may well reflect his particular perspective on the world. So there's a little tip from me. Let me go out this week with some music that came to my mind immediately when I thought of Henry Kissinger, which is the Dead Kennedys holiday in Cambodia. That can be something of a lasting commentary on the dreadful things that Henry Kissinger did in Indochina.
So it's time to taste what you want.